From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Russia is no stranger to conflicts, but under Vladimir Putin, its most enduring one may be the war over news and information. Over the past decade, the Kremlin has virtually eliminated independent television broadcasters and tightened control over the internet inside Russia. Outside Russia, it's also sought to offer its own version of the news in English and other languages. This is often an anti-American narrative about conflicts in Syria, Ukraine, and elsewhere in Eastern Europe, and one that often conflicts with news advanced by other international news agencies. Meanwhile, online, allies of the Kremlin have reportedly hired hundreds, if not thousands, of so-called trolls to spread disinformation on social media and in the comments section of news sites. Today on Global Journalist, a look at Russia's information offensive. Our first guest today worked for Russia Today, an English-language 24-hour news network funded by the Russian government and founded in 2005. Sarah Firth is a British-trained journalist who was a reporter for RT from 2009 until July 18, 2014, one day after Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot out of the sky over eastern Ukraine, killing all 298 passengers and crew on board. Sarah Firth, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah, tell us just a little bit about how you came to begin working for RT.
Well, I'd already been out to Moscow for an internship with a newspaper there whilst I was studying at City University. And when I graduated, I was really interested in going back to Russia. It was a country that fascinated me. And I'd heard about Russia Today. I knew that they were hiring young journalists, and I applied and was offered a very, very good package to go out there. So I sort of had graduated and found myself in Moscow working for RT.
And so tell us just a little bit about what it was like to work there in your early days.
When I started, it was incredibly exciting. I was a very young journalist. I'd had no on-air experience. So it was just really in at the deep end for me. I got to travel a lot around Russia, which was incredibly exciting. I got to see the country that I loved. And I got given a lot of opportunities that I wouldn't have had, certainly back in the UK. For the first couple of years, it was a very, very exciting time.
And then at some point, things started to change for you, or your perspective on the network started to change a little bit. Can you tell us about that?
It did. I think as I gained more experience and as I traveled more and I moved to foreign reporting, so I was traveling internationally, and the stories that I was covering were becoming much more serious, and certainly within the network, much more controversial. For example, my time reporting in Syria. So I think just gradually I came up against a lot of very serious ethical questions that I was asking myself. I became quite unhappy with the pressure that I felt that I was under to deliver what RT were asking me to deliver. And it was a gradual process. You know, at the same time, RT was growing and getting a lot more recognition. And therefore, the stories we were doing, I felt, sort of had a lot more impact. It was a gradual process, really.
And I saw today, actually, you talk about RT's impact. I saw there was a recent survey by Ipsos saying 70 million people around the world watch RT weekly now. So they certainly have grown in influence for a network that was only started a decade ago. But I wanted to ask you about sort of the period starting in the fall of 2013 during the Euromaidan protests in Ukraine, when there really starts to be a lot of tension between the West and between Russia over events there. Tell us about that time inside the network.
It was a very difficult time. You know, there's a lot of very, very good committed journalists that are working at RT, and it was a very close team. It felt very much like a family. And there was a lot of discomfort and a lot of, you know, deep unhappiness, actually, about the way the story was being handled. It wasn't unique to that story. RT had done that in the past. A lot of the journalists there, and I know myself included, I often, you know, would be so frustrated with the way that they would very transparently and often embarrassingly and then sometimes dangerously handle stories like what was taking place in Ukraine. It felt like, as a journalist at RT, you felt your own work being undermined because it was very clear with stories like that, with a lot of the headlines that they were running, that it was very much the sort of pro-government Russian government line. And so it became very difficult to defend what you were doing at RT, to legitimize to yourself the reasons that you were there. And as I said, that was really the story for me, where I couldn't, I got to a point where I couldn't defend my reasons for being at RT anymore.
And then, if we go forward to March of 2014, your colleague Liz Wahl actually quit on air over the network's coverage of Russia's conflict with Ukraine in the Crimea. We actually have a clip of that we're going to play for our audience here, and then I'll ask you just to react to that.
I'm the daughter of a veteran. My partner is a physician at a military base where he sees every day the firsthand accounts of the ultimate prices that people pay for this country. And that is why, personally, I cannot be part of a network funded by the Russian government that whitewashes the actions of Putin. I'm proud to be an American and believe in disseminating the truth. And that is why, after this newscast, I'm resigning.
Sarah Firth, tell us just a little bit, how did you as journalists receive sort of the message about what to report about what was happening in Ukraine, about Russia's sort of support for the rebels there?
Well, it would depend if you're on the story. I wasn't assigned to the story at the time, but if you're assigned a story like that, you get a huge amount of pressure in terms of what you're expected to say on air during lives as a correspondent. When you're on the ground for stories, you send packages and scripts for approval. There's a heavy, heavy editorial interference there from the editors in Moscow. And there's just a great deal of pressure to report the story a certain way. And if you don't do that, the repercussions are pretty immediate. You don't get on at RT unless you are doing what is expected, and that is doing a story in a certain way.
And we are running short on time here, but I wanted to ask you about when you did decide to quit, because it sounds like you had been uncomfortable at the network for a while. Then in July of 2014, we have Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 shot down over eastern Ukraine with 295 people on board. Almost immediately, it seems there's a lot of evidence that it was shot down by a Russian-made surface-to-air missile of the kind used by pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. Talk to us about RT's coverage and your feelings about it.
Again, it was sort of the situation normal for RT in a handling of a story of that impact. It stops feeling like news, and what we're doing doesn't feel like journalism anymore. And also, I think for me at that point, I had such a deep understanding, and I'd seen so many times the huge mishandling of information, and the huge disrespect for actual journalistic practices when a story like that breaks, that I knew what we were doing was not legitimate. I knew that we were not handling that story in the way that a story of that impact should be handled. And so that was the moment that there wasn't any excuse for me anymore. I'd loved a lot of my time at the channel. I'd had some great opportunities, but I'm a journalist first and foremost, and that wasn't journalism. We used to have a sort of tagline amongst journalists saying that RT was views, not news, which would sometimes be quite humorous. But obviously, when you have a story like MH17, you have that weight of responsibility to the viewers who are going to be watching, and to the handling of that story. And so, yeah, it became absolutely indefensible for me at that point to stay around and stay part of RT.
Sarah Firth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at Russia's control of its media, how it's trying to spread its message to other parts of the world and discredit Western news. We're going to bring in three other guests now who have had an up-close view of this issue. Joining me now from Moscow, Andrew Kramer, a correspondent for The New York Times. From Washington, D.C., Karina Orlova, a reporter for Echo of Moscow, a radio station based out of Russia. And from New York, Maria Snegovaya, a columnist at Vedomosti, a Russian business daily newspaper. She's also written for The New Republic and The Washington Post's Monkey Cage blog on political science. Welcome to all of you. Andrew Kramer, you've been in Russia for some time now, and I'm sure that what you report in The New York Times is keenly observed inside Russia. How does the Russian media react when you report something that's critical or negative about the Russian government?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. You mentioned at the beginning this proliferation of online commentary and Twitter and Facebook activity by pro-Russian activists. When I write something that might be interpreted as critical of the Russian government or of Russian policies, it's very common to have an explosion of activity on Twitter that is attacking that that approach. It's rare that the Russian state media will pick up one of the stories reported by a foreign journalist, but that does happen from time to time. Usually, however, it is on this new media frontier where most of the activity takes place.
And Karina Orlova, you've worked for a radio station that did have a reputation, has had a reputation of being independent, sometimes critical of the Kremlin. You ended up leaving the country last year along with some of your colleagues at Radio Echo of Moscow after some threats. Can you tell us just briefly about that?
Oh, yes. I started receiving threats shortly after Charlie Hebdo terror attack in Paris. But they came from Muslim radicals, as these people positioned themselves. But they called me the enemy of Islam and also the enemy of Ramzan Kadyrov because I criticized him on air.
Sorry, this is the Chechen leader then.
Oh, yes, sure, absolutely, the Chechen leader. So there was kind of a mess after Charlie Hebdo attack, and Ramzan Kadyrov publicly threatened to Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and after that to Echo of Moscow journalists, and personally chief editor of Echo of Moscow, Alexei Venediktov. So I criticized him. I hosted a primetime political talk show, and I received some threats, but I didn't pay much attention on that because I took it as a cost for what I do, working for a liberal radio station in Moscow. But after Boris Nemtsov was murdered in the center of Moscow.
This was the opposition leader who was killed back in February of 2015.
Yes, and a former vice prime minister of Russia. And that time, regional parliamentary. So I received several more threats, and I filed a report to the police. Police did nothing, and so I realized that I won't get any help from the police. So I decided to leave the country.
So in other words, then you're saying that you have been threatened both by Islamists, then also after you aired a show which was critical of the Chechen leader and ally of President Putin, you also received threats apparently from sort of pro-Kremlin sources then. Is that fair to say?
Well, no, if we're talking about threats, like death threats, which I received, so they came from people who positioned themselves as being Muslim radicals. But of course, I'm still receiving hate messages from pro-Kremlin people, when mostly from Donbas, from those separatist supporters in Donbas. So, but it's not the same, you know, because it's not quite dangerous. It's more of a hate speeches, hate messages, but they don't seem to look like real threats.
And let me turn this now to Maria Snegovaya. You've done a lot of research on Russia's information strategy. Just give us just a little bit of a layman's explanation of this idea that you talk about called reflexive control.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So very briefly, Russia's information propaganda campaign abroad is based on the famous Soviet military strategy. It's a pretty old Soviet concept that assumes that the key of the information campaign is to influence your opponent, in this case going to be the Western audience, into unknowingly making bad decisions by interfering with what their perceptions of reality are. And it also assumes that you know your enemy well. So basically, supposedly, the Kremlin media must know very well the Western environment in which they operate. Essentially, the strategy is based on so-called 4D approach, in which you either dismiss, distort, distract, or dismay the available information. So the example would be Vladimir Putin, for example, denying for several consecutive months the existence of the Russian soldiers in the occupied Crimea first and then in Ukraine. Or the example of the distort approach would be the famous and notorious Russian actress who played the role of a witness who also allegedly viewed a boy being crucified in Donetsk, etc., etc. So that is very briefly overview of that approach.
So that was sort of an example of manufacturing of fake atrocities then. But Andrew Kramer, let me turn this to you. You heard Karina Orlova talk about some of the pressures on independent journalists inside Russia. Maria Snegovaya talked about sort of this overarching strategy. You've covered the Euromaidan movement, the conflict in Ukraine. What role has Russian language media played in shaping perceptions of this conflict, both in Ukraine and in Russia itself?
Well, it's played a tremendous role. One of the first things that happened in some of these eastern Ukrainian towns when pro-Russian separatists took over was they seized control of the local broadcasting, so that in Donetsk, for example, now you see Russian television. Information was clearly an important part of the strategy on the local level as well as on the international level, which we've been talking about. I think that it's worth talking a bit more about Russia's information policy. There's been a tendency in Russia and the Soviet Union to try to block information coming in, and we see this in the jamming of Radio Free Europe, for example, in the Soviet period, and some of the restrictions put on the internet today, although they're very modest compared to what happens in China. Instead, there's an emphasis on getting their own message out and trying to occupy that information space that they feel that the West has been quite good at. This is what I see as new in Russia's approach. So there's been money poured into RT and into English language publications, other foreign language publications, to promote the Kremlin point of view, both in Ukraine extensively, both nationally in Ukraine before the Maidan movement and then in the East afterward, and in Russia's so-called near abroad, in the region of Russian speakers, and then of course in the English-speaking world as well.
And then, Andrew, just to follow up on this, and do you see that strategy, is it to sort of advance a totally alternative narrative about what's happening in the world, or is it sort of more simply to undermine the news as is being presented by Western media outlets? Like, for example, with the crash of the Malaysian Airlines jet, if you look at RT's coverage, there seems to be sort of a steady drip, drip, drip of coverage questioning what the cause of that conflict may have been, questioning the investigation of it, questioning facts that may emerge from Ukraine.
But the network's motto is question more. So not surprisingly, they would be questioning the Western narrative of what happened there. I think it's a bit of both. It's creating a narrative for news events, which is very Russian-centered and sympathetic to the Kremlin's position, be it on Syria, Libya, or elsewhere. And by the way, some of these positions are defensible. The Russian position on Libya, for example, was not totally ridiculous, and is now an issue in the U.S. campaign whether it was a mistake to have taken down Gaddafi. But in other cases, you know, a Western viewer might see some of the Russian positions as fabricated or fraudulent and merely serving a purpose of as we discuss some of these 4D ideas of dismissing or distorting or denying. Particularly with RT, what I've seen is an inclination to, as it were, turn the tables on the West. They feel that Western journalists like myself have focused on an aspect of Russian politics, which they think is insignificant. This is the liberal opposition movement here, figures who don't bring out more than a few thousand people onto the streets, or who might work for media outlets here in Russia that are very marginal. And they think the West is fascinated or focused on a marginal and unimportant part of the story in Russia, which they see as the revival of a great country and economic return to prosperity and respect in the world under President Putin. So they've turned that around and done the same thing in the West. So you'll see a lot of stories on RT talking to people we would consider conspiracy theorists in America, talking about the Trilateral Commission. They have given plenty of airtime to birthers and truthers, for example. So it's not only undermining our storyline about Russia, but it's questioning questioning some of these mainstream ideas about the United States and about the Western world by giving space and airtime to people we would see as conspiracy theorists.
And I should say that we did invite a senior news anchor at RT onto the show. She initially agreed to be on the show when she heard that Sarah Firth, who of course quit RT, was going to be on the show. She decided that she no longer wanted to join us for our discussion today. I also want to remind our listeners that they're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at Russia's control of its media, how it's trying to spread its message to other parts of the world. Joining us on the line from Moscow, Andrew Kramer, a correspondent for the New York Times. From Washington, D.C., Karina Orlova, a reporter for Radio Echo of Moscow. And from New York, Maria Snegovaya, a columnist at Vedomosti, a Russian business newspaper. Karina Orlova, talk to us just a little bit about how the domestic media environment in Russia has changed over the past decade. Your station, Echo of Moscow Radio, has been known as one of the few remaining independent voices on Russia's airwaves. Is that changing now?
Drastically, and everybody knows that. So if we, it's pretty obviously, and it's going worse and worse every day. And sometimes I guess that these people, they just cannot stop anymore. You know, they should do more and more every time. They should overcome themselves, because when you make a fake story about that crucified boy in Slavyansk, your viewers, they demand more. They want something even more crazy, even more, you know, like dramatical.
Sorry, so this was a state television story, yes, about a boy who was crucified by Ukrainian forces in eastern Ukraine.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it was just so that our listeners know, this story consisted exclusively of a woman. She is insane, obviously, who talked about this. So she just told people that I saw this happened, but nobody else could confirm it, never, ever. So about Echo of Moscow, Echo is being criticized a lot, as you might know that too, because they say that the strategy of Echo of Moscow is to allow different voices to appear on air and on their website, which is very popular. But the thing is that I prefer to have a radio station which allows pro-Kremlin people to be heard, as well as liberal voices to be heard. And the funny thing and the good thing is that those pro-Kremlin experts and journalists, they don't have many views. They don't have much outcome for what they say, for what they write. But if we're talking about liberal blogs or liberal experts, they have thousands of hundreds of thousands of views or listeners.
Well, you raise a good point here, Karina, and I'd like to turn that to Maria Snegovaya. I guess my question is, has Russia's information warfare, has it fundamentally changed popular attitudes about Russia's actions inside Russia, in sort of the neighboring regions? Is it sort of winning this information war, if you will? Karina was just saying that the pro-Kremlin views on her radio station don't get a lot of traction, a lot of response from listeners. How do you see the sort of the overall outcome?
Yeah, just to add to what Andrew and Karina have been saying, Russia is kind of in a trap right now. On one hand, it's claiming that it has its own traditional values and ideology and tries to put forward that image of alternative world, so to put it, to the West, right? Clearly, that project is failing. Nobody is attracted to the image that Russia projects abroad. If anything, it's getting more and more unattractive day by day. Then the alternative approach is to try to feel in the world information environment as much noise as possible. And that's exactly what Russia Today and other channels, as we have been discussing, have been doing lately by very often just crafting fake news or presenting very different and often just wrong viewpoints on a lot of different issues. So that strategy is arguably more or less successful if you look at certain countries. In general, surveys and different polls show that Russia's image abroad has not been improving due to the information propaganda strategies. If anything, most of the European countries, the Western countries, tend to have a very negative image of it. But in some countries, especially with large shares of ethnic Russian populations, the Russian TV channels manage to attract certain viewers and at least to create this doubt in the minds of the audiences, right? Basically, the viewpoint that's being promoted here is that, yes, Russia isn't perfect, but the West isn't perfect either. And in general, there's absolutely no such thing as objective truth, as we know Margarita Simonyan, the editor of RT, personal philosophy is.
Well, let me turn now to Andrew Kramer, because we did hear Maria talking about this issue of sort of the Russian media's influence over former Soviet states. There was a poll in 2014 by Gallup that showed that people in places like Belarus and Kazakhstan, they found Russian media to be more reliable for reporting about events in, say, Ukraine than Western media. So there's sort of this idea that the West is losing an information war and that it should sort of respond by fighting fire with fire. What do you make of that approach?
Well, thank you for the question. This has come up in Ukraine, where they were considering forming an information ministry of some type, and in the EU, where they've discussed funding Russian language television stations to present Western views. My personal view of this is it's obviously disastrous to even accept the premise that there is an information war. And that there's not simply a need for people to have access to objective reporting, to different views that they want to hear, read, or see on television. And this would be buying into the Russian approach and the Russian understanding of the way that the media works, and that these are just propaganda outlets.
So in other words, then, you're saying it's better just to, for the news media, if you will, to continue doing exactly what it is doing. The Voice of America shouldn't become sort of a propaganda outlet broadcasting in Russian, then. Is that fair to say?
Well, Voice of America is a government-funded news outlet, which has its own editorial policy, more closely tied to the government than for example at BBC, or more closely tied to U.S. foreign policy interests. But you're exactly right. I think the answer needs to be is for us to be more like ourselves and not try to counter fire with fire, as you suggested.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist. My thanks to Sarah Firth, Andrew Kramer, Karina Orlova, and Maria Snegovaya for joining us. Global Journalist executive producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Lakshna Mehta, Louise Hemmerly, Li Ying Kwan, and John Doty. Our studio director is Travis McMillan of RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. Until next week, for all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure.